Today, we speak to editors and correspondents across The Guardian in science, in health and in social affairs to ask, how prepared are we for a second wave of COVID-19 infections? From today, sweeping new restrictions come in across the UK to try to limit the rising number of COVID-19 cases.
So today I set out a package of tougher measures in England. Early closing for pubs, bars, table service only, closing businesses that are not COVID secure, expanding the use of face coverings, new fines for those that fail to comply.
Once in Wales,
only travel when you need to do so.
In Northern Ireland and Scotland, social gatherings in homes are banned completely.
So after careful consideration, we have decided that from tomorrow to be reviewed every 3 weeks, and with exceptions that I will come on to, visiting other households will not be permitted.
But while there may not be full agreement on exactly how to act, the four nations do agree on why they need to. The UK has entered the second wave. More than 41,000 people have already lost their lives to COVID-19, with older people, the least well-off, and those of Black and minority ethnic backgrounds hit disproportionately hard. The country now knows what it is dealing with and the threat we face, and politicians know that the public will not easily forgive new mistakes. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, are we ready for the second wave of COVID-19? Back in March, when it suddenly dawned on politicians here in the UK that COVID was about to hit the country and hard, much of the focus was on the NHS.
If too many people become seriously unwell at one time, the NHS will be unable to handle it, meaning more people are likely to die, not just from coronavirus, but from other illnesses as well.
After all, we had watched in horror as this virus brought health services across Europe to their knees.
For Italian doctors and nurses, this has become a marathon of effort and determination.
Tonight, disturbing new images posted across social media in Spain showing patients on the floor of an overwhelmed hospital. Victims heard coughing, some gasping for air, others apparently hooked up to oxygen tanks, doctors unable to keep up.
And we feared that we were next. At The Guardian, our health policy editor, Dennis Campbell, was in constant touch with medical staff to try to understand what was happening inside the country's hospitals.
Before the pandemic struck, there was huge concern that the NHS all over the UK was going to collapse. That was a really, really acute concern across the NHS, across the UK. Happily, it didn't happen. The NHS across the UK proved agile enough and determined enough and bold enough, actually, in the way it responded by doing broadly the same thing, shutting down normal care, repurposing staff and massively expanding critical care. But for the staff involved, this was obviously the biggest thing everyone from a hospital chief exec to a senior doctor to a nurse to a porter had ever dealt with. The sheer emotional trauma of dealing with, at its peak, 19,000 people in intensive care and in hospital with COVID, all of them in a life or death situation. They didn't know what they were dealing with to start with. They invented and came across new treatments and new ways of maximising the chance of people with serious COVID staying alive. The NHS had to forget that it normally does lots of things, that it gives normal operations, outpatient appointments, it screens people, it tests people, it takes blood tests, it does all these things. It had to shove all that aside to concentrate on this most medically vulnerable group of people.
As you say, an extraordinarily traumatising period for health workers. Out of COVID patients who ended up on intensive care, around 40% died. And while the system didn't collapse, the death rate seemed worryingly high. Looking back, do they know what mistakes were made? Do they think they let down patients with different diseases? And as this hits again, will they do things differently?
Clearly not everything was perfect. the Nightingale hospitals were set up in different parts of the UK and were largely unneeded. Some people think that that was a misuse of resources. Other people, including myself, think that was actually a very useful insurance policy they had. The biggest lesson the NHS has learned from how it did in the spring and the tactics it employed are that this time, for the second wave that's coming at us very soon, they can't afford to shut down normal care. We won't know yet the whole cumulative effect of all of this, but we know that a lot of people have seen their health suffer. As a result of that, the NHS in England has taken a big, big strategic decision. This time, they intend to, as far as possible, run normal care alongside COVID care. One element of that will be having some mainly smaller district general hospitals repurposed to be entirely COVID-free hospitals, because the NHS is now facing a huge backlog of cases from the spring of people who need treatment from then, and it knows that it can't afford to have a second backlog on top of the one from the spring.
Okay, so more emphasis on other conditions that were sidelined during the first wave. But on COVID-19 itself, there are predictions that we could now have 50,000 new cases a day by mid-October. And we're heading into winter, into flu season, which is why the government is rolling out a huge flu jab campaign. So it's worrying. And I guess I want to ask if other problems from before are now better, around PPE, around identifying risk, around understanding treatment.
Talking to doctors and hospital bosses in recent days, I get a picture that's sort of slightly contradictory or almost paradoxical of, on the one hand, great apprehension and concern and anxiety about the huge number of COVID patients that could be coming their way within weeks, but also actually a sense of a kind of cautious, tentative optimism that things this time round might be a lot better. Doctors seem to think that there may, the next wave, the second wave, might be kind of longer but flatter. In other words, there might be fewer people in hospital this time around, they hope. Every hospital in the UK has expanded its critical care unit, its ability to provide high dependency and intensive care to patients who need it. They've all put on 20, 30, 40% more beds as per NHS instructions. Some of them are bringing in things like modular wards to give them extra bed space, modular surgical units, and even a modular critical care unit. There are now many more treatments available. There were no treatments really in March, and now there are various forms of drugs that can treat them. There's also much greater confidence that this time the supply and availability of the correct personal protective equipment, the PPE that became such a huge issue for frontline staff and such a big political issue for the government in March, April, May, June, that is going to be, that situation will be an awful lot better this time round. The one thing that's, I think, is still the potential Achilles heel of the plan to run this time both normal care and COVID care simultaneously is that you need staff, and the NHS all over the UK, but particularly in England, has famously staff shortages. And that, I think, is a major question about how long, if the second wave of COVID turns out to be very, very difficult, how long they can keep normal care going.
And to do that, you also need space. One of the things they did at the beginning of all of this was to try to clear out space in hospitals by sending people to care homes. Is that something that they've learned from?
It's not clear to me yet whether or not the NHS has learned the lessons of the large-scale emptying out of non-COVID, mainly elderly, medically vulnerable patients into care homes that happened back in the spring, and which we now know was a key factor in the rapid and disastrous spread of COVID in care homes.
That decision to send so many people into the care sector from hospitals led to a situation in care homes that was truly shocking.
A third of all deaths linked to coronavirus in England and Wales are now happening in care homes, according to the latest figures.
Even from the outside, it's not hard to spot the emergency in our care homes. Within minutes of us arriving at this one in Suffolk, another resident requires an ambulance.
Here on Today in Focus, we spoke to managers who had seen more than a dozen of their residents die after the disease arrived.
How does that feel?
It's devastating. And I, if I'm really honest, I think there's some guilt there. And I know that's totally irrational because there's nothing more that we could have done either, you know, during or before to have stopped it. But I think, you know, you run a care home and you manage it.
And to others who fared better only because they ignored the lack of government advice and took action themselves to ban visits, ensure PPE supplies, and even ask staff to move in.
We're there for each other, we comfort each other, because we are missing our family. Some of these girls have got, you know, young children. Saturday morning, I turned into our hairdresser, did our lady's hair. We had Elvis on in the salon, singing away, had a really lovely morning doing that. And it's just, you know, keeping the minds stimulated and just having fun. Lots of sing songs. We've had sing songs of dance.
Throughout, the Guardian social affairs correspondent Rob Booth covered the crisis. Rob, we know it was disastrous to send so many people from hospitals to care homes during the first wave. This time around, they say they're going to test people, but if someone is suffering from COVID, they could still be sent to a care home if that home agrees. Is it really possible to isolate people in that situation?
This is an area of great difficulty because of the design of the homes. They're communal spaces. They are homes, so they're not built for it. What the government said in its winter plan for care homes is that they want to work with local authorities and the NHS to identify alternative accommodation in cases where care homes can't isolate people safely. That didn't prove easy in the first wave. There were cases, I think, down in Somerset where the council spent months trying to get old care homes reopened as quarantine zones, but were struggling for various different reasons like insurance. And so there isn't a glut of places where people can be quarantined. So there is still this dangerous area where hospitals will be wanting to discharge people into care homes. Care homes will be having to decide, can they take them? And these are judgment calls, which I've no doubt they're going to be far more cautious about than they were originally.
I mean, care homes are under huge financial pressure. Could that weigh on those judgment calls?
Some of the chains are in real financial difficulties, and the occupancy rates are down by about 10% as a result of the death toll in care homes. That's a big deal for the finances of these commercial operations. It's perhaps easier for the larger chains to withstand it. Their investors may be able to ride that out. Smaller chains may not. And so they will be feeling pressure to get occupancy rates back up. And at the same time, of course, people aren't wanting to send their loved ones into care homes in the same numbers as before. So there's a kind of double whammy there. Now, would it change the way they evaluated whether they took someone from hospital with COVID? I doubt that somewhat, not least because there are murmurings of legal actions against care providers who may have done that. Insurers, I know, are very jittery about that and are making demands on care home chains to act very, very cautiously. So we'll wait and see.
How are people you're talking to in the sector feeling? How are some of the care home managers that you spoke to who felt, frankly, terrified last time round? How are they feeling now that a second wave is hitting?
They are tired and they're bracing themselves to go again, as it were. They do have concerns about the mental health of some of their staff and the fact that they're a bit traumatised by some of the stuff that they had to deal with when it was really in high circulation in early April and late March. They are, however, buoyed by some of the measures that have been announced, including free personal protective equipment, so they won't have to worry about that. And they are pleased that the government has extended a £500 million grant, essentially, so that they can pay staff to stay in their homes rather than work as agency staff across different homes. So there's a feeling of, look, we're in a better place than we were, but we're going to have to grit our teeth and hope it's not as bad as it was last time.
And finally, Rob, what about testing within care homes, on which so much seems to hinge? Can managers have confidence in this system now?
the situation with testing in care homes hasn't been as good at all as care home operators want. They've been promised weekly care home testing for staff and monthly care home testing for residents. And often that care home testing for staff has been too slow in coming back. And as a result, they don't feel that they're quite as protected as they need to be. They stress, and you'll hear this across the whole piece with COVID, right? Testing is absolutely vital to how care homes are going to cope with the crisis as we head towards this winter.
Where to start with testing? From the decision early on to stop it completely within the community, to stories now of people being sent hundreds of miles or putting a postcode in Scotland in to secure a test in Nottingham.
I have had two Farnham residents sent to Bristol for their tests.
My disabled constituent Ian Kenny has been trying since the 8th of September to get a home test. I've heard from parents, teachers, a vicar in Luton North all saying there are no walk-in tests, no drive-through tests, no home kits available when they need it.
The response has at times been characterised as a farce.
My daughter's been on 4 days trying to get tests for her and her daughter so her daughter can get back to school, and nobody's turned up. So what do we do? Absolutely diabolical it is.
Last week, the head of the track and trace scheme said they hadn't predicted an upsurge in demand when schools opened.
I don't think anybody was expecting to see the really sizable increase in demand that we've seen over the course of the last few weeks. So none of the modelling was that expected.
And yet this system, they say, is the way they can make this second wave less painful than the first. Sarah Bosley, in your role as health editor, you've written extensively about testing, but the policies are still struggling, aren't they?
It has to be said, it's not just testing. It's test and trace and isolate. And we're actually failing on all three of those. Testing is chaotic, and we know that. We've seen people struggling to get tests. There are more people wanting tests than we have capacity to do them. The demand is exceeding supply. Then there's contact tracing. Contact tracing just is not good enough. The NHS test and trace teams are reaching about 80% of all those who test positive. And then the teams who may be in call centres are actually trying to reach the contacts of those people who've tested positive, and they're getting about 70% of those. So there's a big gap, actually, between the numbers who should be reached and told to self-isolate and the numbers who are actually getting a phone call or an email and agreeing to do it. Self-isolation, the third element, is actually the most important bit of all. Only 20% of people were self-isolating in May when asked to do so. That was from a survey, and there is actual data, but the government hasn't released it. Experts I've spoken to say that it's no better now. People can't afford to stay at home, so they need to go to work, they need to earn money, and they're not willing actually to self-isolate for that reason. That's why this government has now adopted the carrot and stick approach, and they're going to pay £500 to people who are on income support to stay home, which is obviously going to help. And they are also going to fine people who break their self-isolation, which could be from £1,000 up to £10,000.
Do you think that will work? And ultimately, how important is it that those three areas that you have said have so far been failures work when it comes to this second wave?
I think probably it will work, to some degree at least, not because of the financial penalties necessarily, but because you are reminding people that of how important this is. So with all of these things, it's not just the action you take, it's also reinforcing the messaging. And without a doubt, the second wave is coming because we actually don't believe it anymore. Lots and lots of people have stopped self-isolating. They've stopped worrying about whether they meet people or not, and they're mixing with lots of people, whether it be in pubs or in their own homes or whatever.
Coming up, the government imposes stringent new restrictions on our freedoms, but do all scientists agree that this is the right way forward? Sarah, scientists are pretty unanimous that testing is key in whatever strategy you follow. But beyond that, is there agreement about how we should respond to this new wave from a public health point of view?
I think everybody agrees that something has to be done. We can't just carry on as we are. But the differences of opinion are very great over how we should do it. So you've got Chris Whitty and Patrick Vallance, the chief medical officer, chief scientific advisor, who are very anxious about this indeed. But there are people who say, firstly, we shouldn't be getting hysterical about the cases rising, that really the only thing that matters is the numbers of people in hospitals and the deaths. Those are not going up as sharply at the moment. They are going up, but it doesn't look exponential as it does if you look at the graph of the cases rising. So you've got people who are saying, hang on a second, we shouldn't just clamp down the whole economy and stop people socialising immediately because of this. We should perhaps target our interventions. So we, in some way, try to help protect the elderly, which actually probably means the over 65s, and also anybody who's vulnerable. The over 65s, that's pretty controversial because a lot of people over that age are very fit and very healthy. So it obviously varies, but there's no doubt about the death toll that this disease can take in people over 65. 85% of deaths are in those people. And if you add in those with underlying conditions, you've got 95% of deaths. That's one school of thought. And it's scientists like Carl Hennigan at Oxford and Professor Gupta. Those people actually did go to a meeting with Boris Johnson on Sunday and I think tried to persuade him of this view.
But one sec, if we think back to the beginning of all this, they considered the idea of isolating somehow the most vulnerable. And the consensus across the world seemed to be that it is almost impossible to do that because older people mix with younger people. They even often live with them.
Yes, and it's incredibly bad for everybody's mental health if you separate out those older people. It's incredibly difficult to do with the best will in the world. And that's why we didn't do it earlier in the pandemic and why other countries aren't doing it either. You cannot actually segment society in that way.
Everything we've spoken about up to now, whether it's hospitals, care homes, or wider society, has been about either slowing the spread of COVID through changing our behaviour or treating infections once they do happen.
There's evidence that it's pointed in the right direction, and it's possible that some vaccine could be available before the end of the year in small amounts.
But there is another way, which has so far been out of reach, a vaccine. This week, the chief scientific advisor, Patrick Vallance, tentatively said that we could have one by the end of the year. And US President Donald Trump has been much more optimistic. He thinks one could be ready in time for November's election.
I'm optimistic that it'll be probably around that date. I believe we'll have the vaccine before the end of the year, certainly, but around that date, yes, I think so.
Ian Sample, as our science editor, you've been talking to the scientists on the front line of this research every day. How close are we really?
There are nine companies, or nine vaccines, should I say, in the final stages of trials at the moment. And there's like about 240 in development, about nine in the final stages of trials, right? By the end of the year, a few of the front runners think they will have data on whether their vaccines work. Does that mean you have a vaccine? You could easily tout that as we have a vaccine, meaning we think we've got a vaccine that works. Does that mean we've got a vaccine we can start giving to the general population? That's a very different thing. So what Patrick Vallance over here, the chief scientific advisor, said over here is something along the lines of there is a chance a very small number of people may get a vaccine before the end of the year. Now, maybe, and a very small number, and those would be healthcare workers. I don't think those numbers would be significant. And I think it's a bit of a distraction to think that way. I think the regulators will start looking at these vaccines and looking at their data before the end of the year. And that is if there aren't any more problems or hiccups with any of these vaccines. That is with everything going perfectly until that data is collected. And then I think we're looking at spring, summer next year for vaccines to be rolled out at any scale. And that is still absolutely breakneck speed. That would be a phenomenal achievement. Let's not forget that.
There was certainly a lot of excitement about the Oxford vaccine, and that was one of the nine you're talking about. But there have been worrying reports of trial patients falling ill. What is the latest?
So we know that with the Oxford vaccine, two women who were on the UK arm of the trial, both of whom had the vaccine, so they weren't in the placebo group, both of them had developed conditions that had sort of neurological symptoms. One of them was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis, but the thinking is that this was actually an undiagnosed case before the trial started. There was then a second woman in the UK trial as well, who also experienced neurological issues, although there's no formal diagnosis that we've had from AstraZeneca or Oxford. But that, again, is said to be a condition called transverse myelitis, which is actually can sometimes be a symptom of multiple sclerosis, which is causing some scientists some concern as to whether it's obviously linked to the vaccine. I mean, it may not be, and the fact that the trials have restarted in the UK and in every other country apart from the US suggests that there is some confidence among the regulators that those problems weren't caused by the vaccine. But the US FDA haven't restarted the Oxford trial in the US. So I think there is still, at least in the US regulators' mind, some question mark over what happened with the second person who fell ill in that trial.
And that just shows, doesn't it, how many hurdles there are in the way of getting a vaccine to the market. As you say, even breakneck speed would still mean probably next summer in terms of scale. And then beyond that, we have concerns, don't we? First of all, will there be people who don't feel confident about having that vaccine? But also, one thing we've talked about before, it's not like this vaccine is going to be a silver bullet necessarily, is it? It could be something that's quite effective, but not 100% effective.
No, I mean, it's interesting to look at what the vaccine manufacturers are actually aiming for. So their goal is a vaccine that is 50% effective. And you can take that as being at least 50% effective. But so that is their goal. They're not looking for 90% or, 98%, as you see with the measles vaccine, for example. They're looking for 50. And, there are vaccines out there, malaria, for example, where the vaccine is about 30% effective. If you look at the seasonal flu vaccine, on a good year, it's about 65% effective. 50% isn't appalling and isn't particularly, isn't wildly unusual. But, we're not looking at people, even if you got this vaccine and it was shown to be effective and safe, you've got 50% chance that it's actually going to help you. What you hope it will be is another, hopefully, big tool that helps you chip away at this R value, that helps you chip away at the number of people that any infected person goes on to infect themselves. So you need other stuff, other preventative measures to try and really tamp it down.
Which is why we have all these new measures. But from a scientific perspective, are they ones that will work? Is there a good reason, for example, that Scotland and Northern Ireland have gone further in banning people meeting at home? And do you think people will follow the rules?
There are absolutely and actually pretty obvious hotspots for the virus spreading. I mean, viruses are simple things. They spread in simple ways. I mean, it's, if you put a lot of people together in an enclosed room, you will get a lot of virus spreading. If those people are spread out, if they're outside and there are wind currents around, if they're wearing masks, all these things diminish your chances of spreading it and picking it up. So what you've got to do is just look at where are we getting most cases from? What kinds of situations, and then basically reducing those as much as you can. I mean, one scientist put it to me as if we basically have a budget of risk, and then we choose how to spend that budget. And so, you can stay in the whole time and maybe do a little bit of this, a little bit of that, which might increase your risk going out, going to the shops, whatever. But the country has to, and the government really has to just decide, okay, how are we going to tell the people how to spend their budget of risk, which, should be decided around the idea of keeping the R level you know, the reproduction level sort of really close to one, hopefully below one. But look, I mean, scientists I've spoken to today have said that the measures we're bringing in England that Boris Johnson announced are not going to be enough to bring R down below one, i.e. it will not make the epidemic shrink.
And finally, Ian, as science editor, this must be one of the biggest stories you've covered in your career, from the questions about the virus itself, how it behaves, who it infects, where it spreads, to how we treat it and how we prevent it. As we watch right now these numbers rising worryingly, and knowing what you do about how prepared we are this time, how worried are you?
Well, look, we are in a second wave, if you like that terminology. I don't know if the wave really helps, but there are more cases than there were after lockdown. Those cases, I suspect, will continue to rise, and I suspect they will trot along at reasonably high levels until who knows, until perhaps the spring. That will actually translate into a lot of people getting ill. It will be probably a reasonable number of deaths, but I suspect it will be fewer percentage-wise than in the spring. But all this, I suppose, is contingent on what we all do.
That was our science editor Ian Sample, health editor Sarah Bosley, social affairs correspondent Rob Booth, and health policy editor Dennis Campbell. All of them have been brilliantly covering the impact of this pandemic. Do read all their work alongside other correspondents, including our Westminster team, for all the analysis. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Joshua Kelly and Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.